are so welcome to the Alison Spittle Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. I am Alison Spittle. I'm going to chat shout with you after the interview because, feck it, that's just how I roll. This week's guest is John Connors, who is so lovely. When he came up to the studio, I suppose because I'm used to seeing him shoot people, you know, and if you've seen Cardboard Gangsters, I don't know what I was expecting, but he was just so nice and so thoughtful and so intelligent, and I had so much to say. And I think it's been one of my favourite interviews, actually. Like, it was really, really cool to chat to him. And that's why I love doing the podcast, because I get to chat to interesting people. Now, I have such big news about shows that are coming up in the future, live ones. So please, if you want to hear about that, just keep on after the interview. Right, good luck. This is the
Recording?
Yeah, we're recording, but we don't have to, like, we don't have to go into podcast mode straight away.
Okay.
I hate that type of, like, starting off with questions of, so, Cardboard Gangsters. Yeah. Because it's all just a big chat. That's what people listen for anyway. It's for, like,
That's very true. Yeah, well, the Joe Rogan podcast would be the opposite of that. Like, he's would be very just smoothly into it.
Yeah, but he's got such interesting guests. Do you ever hear that policeman? He's from Baltimore, and he's just because of the whole Black Lives Matter thing, he says the police are being trained really badly.
Yeah. That was brilliant. That learned me a lot, actually.
Me too, yeah.
I was going over to do a documentary over there, and I ended up listening to that, and how the police have been militarized and trained literally like Marines now, and they shoot to kill. And I ended up coming across this piece of news, and I don't know if you listen to the Young Turks.
I watch the Young Turks occasionally. Yeah, do you know when like a news story comes up and nothing else is on mainstream media coming up?
I actually don't watch it anymore because I got pissed off at them. But
oh, really?
Yeah. Why? Oh, they're just a bit like they claim to be the pure liberal anti-establishment, and then they're not really. They're not like, when it comes to certain subjects, when it goes on Israel, even though they'd be pro Palestinian, but barely.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, and they're just not really lefties to me anyway. But I came across a bit of news that was about this policeman who got a call about someone who was going to kill themselves. Right. And they were pointing a gun to their head, and he landed on the scene by himself, and he had his gun. And instead of shooting him, he was talking him down, and he talked him down so that his gun was then down by his side. And then two policemen came in behind him and just came in straight in and just, without asking any questions, just killed the fella stone dead. And then the dude, the policeman who talked him down, he lost his job for not killing him immediately, because that's now the protocol. You have to, if someone has a gun, you have to kill them immediately. Like, shoot the killer immediately.
Right.
So he literally lost his job, even though he talked the fella down. I just thought that was mad.
Well, I think, do you know what's really fucked up about, because you did a documentary on Black Lives Matter, didn't you?
Well, not, it wasn't specifically on Black Lives Matter, I was a part of it. I did one on African Americans and then one on Native Americans, the Lakota people.
Because do you ever watch Chris Rock?
Yeah.
And do you know his bit, he says that Native Americans have it worse.
Yeah.
Because he says, how many Native Americans do you know and all this?
When they even see two together.
Yeah, exactly. You've done it better than me.
Yeah.
But so what was it? What did you discover while you were doing that documentary?
What I discovered is pretty depressing.
Yeah.
Which is just like, there's no hope. You know what I mean? When I went to Chicago and I was in 79th Street, which is, you know, probably the worst place or hood, if you want to call it, for lack of a better word, in America for killings or shootings, you know, and Chicago's the highest murder rate, shooting rate, and it was just the hopelessness there, like, you know. And on 79th Street, I met a fellow who hadn't seen a white man in 3 years, he told me. And I was just, literally went from, say, where the violence interrupter program building is, they were these ex-gangsters who are all say if you get shot, they're at your bed straight away, trying to stop you from revenging the shooting, and they work with people in the community that are all ex-gangsters, ex-OGs, old gangsters, yeah. You know. And I left the building just to go over to get some chicken and just to go around the place by myself.
What kind of chicken, John?
Just big bucket of chicken. I seen a big bucket of chicken for like $10 for like 20 pieces, and I said, give me that.
Amazing. I'm totally going to ask you, by the way, beautiful. About food after.
Oh, stop. But and then I just met this fella, and I just thought, he was looking for a job actually in the chicken place, and he said, you're the first white man I've seen in, I think it was 2 years or whatever. And I said, that's crazy. How do you...
Yeah.
How was that happening? He said, well, the only place to see a white person is in the city, you know, and I haven't left the south side. And it's so every neighborhood, every street is a funeral parlor, a liquor store. And it's just a feeling of hopelessness because they have the whole system stacked against them. And the police force included, like every single day, at least one black man is shot dead unarmed. And, you know, I got a really interesting perspective of one black activist there. He was sort of like a Malcolm X character. He was amazing. I learned a lot from him. His perspective was that, believe it or not, the civil rights movement, and not specifically the civil rights movement, but the desegregation, the segregation of black people and white people, was the ruination of black people. Because
wow.
During segregation, they had their own hoods and whatever. They had their own neighborhood. Sorry.
Yeah.
And they owned their own businesses, and they spent the wealth spread it within the community. But once desegregation happened, then the white man came in and owned all the businesses in their neighborhoods, and he took all the money out of it. And then whatever black men that would do well eventually left the neighborhood and wouldn't stay where they are to go to a more whiter neighborhood and be more assimilated and kind of go against black culture. That was one of the arguments. And I never seen that perspective or heard that perspective before. So it was an interesting trip for just meeting people like that.
Yeah, and did that kind of did that put like the traveller rights in Ireland kind of into perspective or anything?
What it made me think was, thank God that the An Garda Síochána Síochána don't have guns.
I know.
You know what I mean?
I mean, have you seen half of them? Like, if they did have a gun.
Oh my God, you were like, we were fucked. I mean, I think travellers would be extinct.
Yeah.
Because the amount of times I've just been pulled up for absolute no reason and searched and beat up and being called knacker and bikey by guards throughout my life. Like, I've literally never had, the only times I've had positive experiences with guards was when I got a bit of fame and it was love-hate related when he pulled me up and met me. But before that, I never had one positive experience with a guard, you know. So, yeah, maybe just think, thank God that they don't have guns over here, you know. But you know, the funny thing is about racism versus their racism. Our racism in some ways would be a lot more visible, you know, like it'd be uncommon to come across an African American person over there today that have been, especially in a place like Chicago, which is the most segregated place in all of America, to be actually called the N-word to their face by a white person. That'd be uncommon, you know, and that sort of and being refused from certain places all the time, that'd actually be uncommon enough. But there is that systemic racism, of course, and within the police force is one of the main ways. So in some ways, driver racism is way more obvious, you know.
Well, I think some people still feel it's acceptable because travellers are white and they feel they're not being racist. Do you know what I mean?
That's an argument I've come up against a lot of the time. But when you're talking about racism anyway, and you're talking about race in itself is only a social construct anyway. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But as long as that's the terminology you're using, saying that it's racist against, or it's racism if you discriminate against travellers, is acceptable because it's only a social construct anyway. And if you Google the definition of it, it says that it says even discriminating against people over culture, which, let's say, that's what it's over. But yeah, I've seen a lot of people that exactly what you said, just to justify it because we're white.
Yeah, because I know so many people that are on the left, that feel they're on the left.
Yeah, exactly.
And that the last bastion of discrimination would be against travellers.
Yeah, well, that's how I kind of separate a real liberal to the Irish liberals. And I use an analogy that if you were to get of these 10 of these liberals around the table having dinner, drinking wine, eating steaks and whatever the fuck, and...
If someone talked about
met this black fella today and had a bit of an argument, that fucking N-word, you know what I mean? Everybody would attack him almost, you know. But if someone went to have this argument with a child today and a dirty knacker, pikey, whatever, I don't think anybody would bat an eyelid. And that's the difference between Irish liberals and just a real liberal. Because it's very, very rare you will get a real one. Like, I know people who are call themselves socialists and communists. And,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And are for the Palestinian cause and this cause and that cause. But when it comes to travellers, they're only dirty knackers. That's different. We're knackers. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And that goes way back. That's a dehumanisation process that began 100 years ago with the Irish Free State, you know.
And how did that begin?
Like, that was always sort of the thing that I didn't really know where it really came from, you know, growing up. And the more I researched and looked into it, it became a lot more obvious that when the Irish Free State was formed, a lot of the country was blew up to bits and they were looking for foreign investment, particularly from America. And they talked about in the Dáil the ugly image of the tinker in the countryside. And that it would shy away from foreign investment, basically. So they debated about it even about in the Dáil. And in the 20s, you start seeing some of the first propaganda pictures in the newspapers. And the same sort of pictures that would have surfaced 60 and 70 years before in London and in New York about the Irish.
Yeah.
Painting them as beasts and alcoholics who were thieving and blah. The exact same propaganda. And if you look at a lot of the things that happened from there forward to Travers, was literally a repeat of tactics that was used by the British against the Irish. That the settled government used against Travers, exact same. So through the 20s and 30s, they started to bring in more and more vagrancy laws and different policies. And it all culminated in the 1963 report on itinerancy.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie High headed that. And the exact words were to find a solution to the itinerant problem. Okay, and there was loads more. The final solution to the itinerant problem.
They did not, oh my gosh.
Yeah, and there was loads of different stuff. And there were suggestions to the... There were suggestions to them to take all the children. There were suggestions made to the commission to take all the children so there'd be one less an itinerant in the generation. And a lot of Travers children were taken disproportionately as well.
Yeah.
And then after that, then things really started to change. And the whole famine thing, where we came from the famine, that was a thing to use as a propaganda tool to justify the actions of the Irish government. So to tell people in the settlement that these are just failed settled people who lost their land and now they're trying to assimilate. When really the truth is that the Irish as a whole have been the most nomadic people in the history of Europe, probably.
Yeah.
You know, we were known as the Wandering Irish.
Yeah.
And we were still wandering, like 2/3 of the population were nomadic right up until the reconquest of Ireland, even just 400 or 500 years ago. And at that point, martial law was even brought in to stop so many people from travelling, because if they travelled, they couldn't stay one put and pay taxes to the Queen or the monarchy. So that was one of the reasons. And if you look at the DNA split now, we looked at the DNA split with the documentary I done.
Yeah.
And the DNA split between travellers and settled people, where they stop intermarrying with each other, is around the time of the reconquest of Ireland and before. And that's when a lot of people started to settle because of martial law that came in. So travellers continued their nomadic lifestyle of the Irish.
Yeah, so travellers refused to be serfs then.
Yeah, and refused to assimilate.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because to settle was to assimilate.
Yeah.
You know, that was plain and clear, you know.
And, no, because, like, because my gran told me, like, when I asked her, like, how are travellers different from settled people, she said she basically fobbed it off and said something about the famine and said that people continued kind of moving and stuff like that. But, like, a lot of people just don't know.
That's what she was told.
That's exactly what she was told. And, but the EU and the UN have recognised travellers as, what is it? They've recognised travellers as their
traveler
own race.
Traveller ethnicity. Yeah.
And, like, is Ireland not embarrassed by the way they're treating travellers at this stage, or?
Well, that's the thing. Well, eventually, a few months ago, the Irish government recognised it. Traveller ethnicity, and it was because of the pressure from Europe, because there was different reports done, and they showed that travellers were not only the most discriminated against people in the whole island, but by a long mile.
Right.
And a part of the whole ethnicity thing then was the pressure they were getting from Europe, and they were fear of sanctions because of many different inspections that was done by European commissioners who come over.
Yeah.
And they finally recognised traveller ethnicity, but I don't think it met any difference immediately. I don't think it will immediately. I think it's something for young people. I think it's something for identity, something, you know, because our culture has changed and was forced to change so much that I think it's a good thing for them. You'll only really see the benefits of it in maybe decades to come, thank God it happened, but racism, discrimination against travellers, still rampant. Even just last week, my family were subjected to near torture by the An Garda Síochána Síochána and the ERU, the Emergency Response Unit, who came into my camp without a warrant and got my family down on the ground and put assault rifles to their head and tried to blow their heads off and stuff.
Yeah.
And they did it with no care, and you know, they didn't give a fuck, and they were laughing, and no one would give their name and no one would give their badge number.
Did no numbers.
And they're just one of the oppressive tools of the state, you know, and they always have been. I mean, their face has always been there when my people have suffered, whether it's just pure harassment because of who they are, or whether it's getting moved on from one place to another, which is the ironic thing, they always wanted us to settle, and then you settle in a place and they tell you to fuck off.
Yeah.
So I know we're kind of a confused people at the moment. We don't know what we're being told to do, you know. But yeah, again, I wouldn't have had many positive experiences with them, so I can't treat someone with respect. Or now, mind you, if I'm just come across and meet a new guard that I've never met, I'll treat him with respect until he doesn't treat me with it. And,
Do you find it weird now that you're famous that like the people will treat you a bit different than, like, let's say, like your relative of yours because they're not famous?
Yeah, like I get a lot of just people who know that wouldn't have given me the time of day a few years ago, and I just kind of, it's made me more kind of more closed in, you know, and just more kind of making my circle smaller or keeping it the same size and not really expanding on it.
Yeah.
But you know, and still, even I get people that approach me and they go like, they think just because I've acquired a bit of fame and that I'm an actor, that somehow I must be a different type of traveller.
That's disgusting.
Or, you know, like, not a traditional traveller. Maybe, you know, an assimilated traveller who's settled. And see, this whole thing of a settled traveller, there's no such thing.
No.
This is the thing that's been used. It's very annoying. We were forced to settle. No travellers now travel. And anyway, but we're not settled travellers. But even the word traveller doesn't encompass who we are as a people, because nomadism was merely a vehicle to protect our culture. Which was based around the Tua clan culture. Like, if you look at even the formation of a site, a campsite, which is your family around you, your brothers, your sisters, your aunts, your uncles, your first, second, third cousins, okay? That's the exact same as the ancient Tua, that clan culture, which is the different sets of names. And within my camp, you get four or five different names, but we're all related, either first, second, or third cousin, or aunts, or uncles, whatever, you know? And that's the Tua, and that's all we're trying to keep that culture going, and they're trying to destroy that culture, you know?
And, How are you? How do you see a way for you to fight to keep your culture? Like,
yeah, well, the trick is.
And what can settled people do about it, actually?
Well,
except be what give can, you platitudes and go. Do you know what I mean?
What can you know?
Yeah,
I don't think. Look, it's not down to settled people. Like, you could say, be more open minded. Don't listen to what you read and hear and in the paper and all that, and you know, all the stuff that just have us divided so that the government can conquer us. I could say all that and I do all that spiel, but really, look, I'd be more interested in just empowering travellers, really, to be stronger and to become more politically aware and to get more educated, but not even necessarily more educated in school and go further, not even that way, but just more educated as to where the fit in society and about our history and our culture and our past. And I think if you know that, I think you have a strong idea of where you're going to go or where you want to go. And that's what kind of happened to me when I found out a lot of that, and I became more educated than that. And I educated myself that I became driven in a way that I never was before. And it was swallowing the blue pill in the Matrix, you know, and I kind of seen the whole thing. And that's why I ended up moving back into the camp, because I realised I was living in a country governed by these parties that have been trying to destroy my culture. I'm going to move back into the camp so I can try to preserve it, which is hard enough to do it.
Yeah.
It's hard enough to do living in a camp, never mind living in a house,
yeah,
which is the official assimilation policy of the government.
And so you're living in a camp now.
Mm, yeah,
and what do you like about living in a camp?
Have all my family around me.
Yeah.
Just free. Freedom. And we have a bit of greenery and, you know, a few trees around us and 40 dogs and, you know.
Are they all like Jack Russells or?
Yeah, but there are a few bigger ones. Like, but mostly Jack Russells and Terriers.
And
little mongrels. I have a mongrel dog, Max.
Max.
His full name is Maximus Decimus Aurelius. Got that from The Gladiator.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
But yeah, like, you have all that, and it's just it's a bit more, it's a bit more back in time, you know, just a bit more back in time and a bit more, you're kind of more grounded and you know what's important, you know, and you're around it all day and you're around your family. And like even all my family, like I've hundreds of my family live within 1 mile of me even, outside of the side even, you know. And I just think that's the way I was brought up and it's the way, that was my norm. So when I moved into the camp, even though we're only across the way from, when I moved into the house, even though we're only across the way from the camp, I just didn't feel right. I said I have to go back to what was familiar to me, you know. And if I ever do have children and all that, that's the life I want them to live, you know.
And I suppose this brings me around to Cardboard Gangsters because I felt like watching Cardboard Gangsters, you put in a lot of issues that are important to working class people in Ireland, such as bailiffs and drug culture and stuff. Like, was that always on when you wrote your film, were you always kind of like aware of social issues within Ireland? And
yeah, well, like living in Darndale a long time as well, you're aware of them. And, you know, I was kind of double fucked. Number one, I was a traveler. Number two, I had the address of Darndale.
Yeah.
Which is another thing, you know. And like besides being a traveller, I'm also a Northsider, which is another minority, a Darndaler, a working class person. And to be fair, even less than working class, social welfare class for the most part.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's what really my background. So I'm not just passionate about equality for my own people and for anybody, because there's no such thing as equality until everybody's equal.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Or else there's an imbalance there. So anything that I am ever going to create or be involved in creating is going to have some sort of social or political commentary. The trick is to do it without preaching, because I don't believe that's a strong method if you want to do something or prove something, or, you know, because I think you treat an audience with a bit of intelligence. And in Cardboard Gangsters, we tried to do, we just kept it real.
We just kept
it real. This sort of thing actually happens, and it does make young fellas more desperate to do these sort of things. And we just did it in a way where we weren't judging the gang. We weren't condemning him, and we weren't glorifying him either. It was just showing exactly why he loved this life and exactly what happens in that life, you know, and maybe the consequences that could lead into it.
And how like, were you very involved with the filming process? Because you wrote it and you're acting in it.
Yeah, well, I wrote it for like 3 years, and then I gave it to Mark O'Connor to do work on it. He worked on it for 9 months. Mark was very inclusive because it was my world that he was sort of being invited into. And I sort of created this world, and I grew up around this area and living in the area as well for 7 years in the middle of it. And he just wanted to do it justice. So, I mean, me and him were talking about our inspirations for the film, I say, visually, or, you know, and the sort of tone that we're trying to set, and how we were going to cast it and the music we were going to use. And then in the edit, I missed the say first probably a couple of months of the edit because I was doing a couple of documentaries. And then after that, I was in the edit the whole way.
Yeah.
Till the very end. And then we ended up having to make very tough decisions and do reshoots and push the edit back 3 or 4 months and cost us more money. And we had no more money. And going to hell and back for the film, because it was hard to even fund it. Hard, actually. It was nearly impossible to even get funded in the first place, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was there. I was included in the whole process. And it was great. You know, I'm working with Mark again. It's my third time working with him. And we're just like two big children, you know, really, when it comes down to it. And we just love film, and we love fucking pushing it, really, you know.
No, you looked like it. I have two scenes I want to talk to you about. Number one, you're in your bedroom, you're having a cry, and then you start punching the walls. Was that one take, was it?
Yeah, that was one take, yeah.
Were you aware that it was like going to be one take? We have to break up this room once. And
not really. We didn't even talk about breaking the room up. Like,
really?
No, there was no. It wasn't in the script.
No.
It was... there was something about Jay contemplates about what happened, blah, blah, blah. You know, he's intense. He, you know, because of the scene that has just happened. It's a kind of a very important scene. It's one of the most important scenes for Jay, for his arc, because you see that he isn't just another gangster, that he is a cardboard gangster. And the difference is he doesn't have that psychopathic quality. He has a bit of humanity about him. And that sort of tears him up. And we knew that it was going to be, that something was going to have to happen in that scene. And me and Mark, I woke up that morning and I was just kind of shaking, and because I was kind of avoiding that scene, you know. And but I knew something had to happen, and I knew what I had to do to get somewhere, you know. And I just had a chat with Mark about it that morning, and I just went, look, just we'll all just let's get everybody ready, and I don't know what's going to happen. And he went, look, It's like he said, it's like a tsunami. It comes in and destroys everything, you know. But he said something like that. I can't remember him saying that. He told me he said that. He definitely did say something like that. But I was kind of, I was distracted, you know, so I couldn't really hear what he was saying to me. But anyway, I didn't know that was going to manifest physically, you know. I didn't know what was going to happen with it. And then Mark just had the sort of instinct to say, I think this is going to be a one take or so.
Yeah.
So everybody have your shit together. And make sure it's focused, and make sure all this, you know. And then,
could you imagine if?
Yeah, so to imagine, you know, imagine if it all happened, they never got it. Someone would have to die.
Someone would.
So yeah, it worked out the way it worked out, and it ended up being kind of a favorite scene for a lot of our festival audience in America, Manchester, and they all liked it. So that was cool, you know.
No, it was nice to see him cry, and it was nice to see, because he kind of came off to me like a kind of John Wayne figure, especially like with his girlfriend and everything, because I'm pure on the girl's side, and I was like, he's a bollocks, you know? I was like, who does he think he is going in? She's a big ride. I was like, you know? But the other scene, like, because I wrote my own sitcom and I acted in it as well, and it got edited down there, like, so I totally kind of know where, that's why I'm asking you about, well, how many takes did you have to do or whatever, because it's very, but I just you know the scene in outside the nightclub with the main lady Kirsten, it's the on the stairs.
Oh yes.
Yeah, how did you prepare for that there?
Right, well, that was kind of awkward.
Shall I tell the listener at home what the scene was? So it was a sex scene, an intimate scene beside a nightclub. That's how I would describe it.
Yeah. I was very nervous, and we did it a couple of times, and I was we did it a couple of times, and I couldn't get it, it wasn't real, I couldn't get into it, and then Kirsten, who was the actress, who was a great actress, she worked with Fassbender and Tom Hardy and loads of big productions, she was the lead in a Ken Loach film, who was probably my favourite director. She turned around and just said, "Look, just fucking do it for real. Just fucking fuck, like, not for real, but you know what I mean. Go for it, you know."
Yeah.
And then once I knew that she was okay, then I was okay, and then we went and done it. So,
that's cool. Because I don't know, like, if I did a sex scene, like, I wouldn't make it too real because I don't want people to know what I'm like at writing, but I want to do it good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you'd be giving it the full mark. Oh, yeah. But it was totally like, because we were doing the podcast and stuff, and I was like, I've seen him write. So I want to ask everyone as well, like, if they've been to America, have you ever been to a Denny's?
Yeah, Denny's.
What's it like?
Yeah, the breakfast is good.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's what I liked. Pancakes and bacon.
Right, nice.
Yeah, that was nice. Something different.
That's a good combo.
Yeah, pancakes and bacon, yeah. I ended up getting a luncheon at one time and I didn't like it. I liked the breakfast in it, yeah. And my favourite over there was a place called Dallas Barbecue.
Okay, is that like a chain now or is that a one?
It's a chain.
Oh, it's a chain.
It's a chain, yeah. You'll get it all across America. And I remember... I'd have a very big appetite, and I remember I was over there and I was on steroids because I had Bell's palsy. Half my face was paralysed.
Was that from stress or what?
I think so. Yeah, I think I was going through a kind of a stressful patch. All right, the doctor said that's one of the causes. And I went into this Dallas Barbecue. My appetite was huge, and I got this. I said I'll get large wings and I'll get a full chicken for my main.
Oh my god!
And the sides.
How many?
And the large wings came out, and it was a big, huge tray.
Yeah.
And one of the wings was the size of my fist, and there was 12 of them. And people were looking at me like, whoa, and I actually ate every one of them.
Nice.
Every single one of them. And about half my dinner. It was a bit of a feat, I think.
That's an achievement.
I gained like I think a stone and a half in like 8 days over there.
Really?
Because I was on steroids and I was just constantly eating.
Gee, and were you worried when you got the Bell's palsy because you're an actor and stuff? Like,
yeah.
They don't know when it leaves. I had a friend who had it, like, and she didn't sleep for ages, and that's why it happened.
Yeah, they say it could anywhere for a couple of weeks up until a year or two, do you reckon?
Yeah.
And this was my second time having it, so they said that it could even be never. That was a possibility.
Jesus.
That it would never come back. The doctor said, like, it is a possibility. Because he didn't say it to me until I asked him. I said, look. Is it like, will
you're
it
like,
ever?
Give it to me straight,
like,
doc.
Like, well, there is a small chance it could never come back, he said. And I said, oh, no. Which kind of ruined me American trip a bit. And, you know, and plus I was on the medication. And he said, I can't drink on the medication. And I was over there in America for the first time.
Yeah,
you know. But that was New York that time. And it was Yeah, it was a great spot.
So you found solace in the chicken wings?
I did, yeah.
Good.
I did, yeah. And I, you know, because I didn't drink, I ended up going to all the touristy places and, you know, yeah, done probably everything you do in New York.
Cool.
As a tour. So then when I went back, I didn't have to do any of that. I just
drank.
Yeah, just drank. With my Irish American buddies.
Nice. I wonder, because I skipped over it because I'm an idiot, but I want to know about Native Americans. Like, what was it like with them?
Oh, that was yeah. Again, I got that sort of you know, the hopeless thing, because they've all the odds stacked against them. But even with the African Americans, they have great voices, they have great colourful characters and strong people, and you know, you have the Malcolm X's, the Martin Luther King's, and there's people now still today fighting their corner. With the Native Americans, there's none of that really, and they're a much smaller population.
Yeah.
So there's kind of that feeling of hopelessness. But just when you get into their culture and you meet the older ones, and that's, it's unbelievable. Like they did a Sweat Lodge for me, and it was, because it was a traveller, actually, that's why he did it. Milo Yellowhair, who was my guide.
Yeah.
And he was bringing me around everywhere for 4 or 5 days, and I had planned to do an interview with him. And then the day he was doing a Sweat Lodge, they start maybe 6 o'clock in the morning burning the rocks, and you end up doing a Sweat Lodge about 8 p.m. or something. And I'll arrive there at about 7, and I just started interviewing him without telling him, and he was telling me about Bobby Sands and how it inspired the American Indian movement was in it, and how they took huge inspiration from the Provisional IRA and Bobby Sands and the Hunger Strikers. And he was a very emotional in the interview, you know. And then we couldn't film the Sweat Lodge, obviously. It's against the rules. And yeah, I did it. And he went, before I walked in, he says, look, you're going to experience the white man's two biggest fears, fire and darkness. And I went, okay. And I walked in, and I was the very furthest away from the door.
Yeah.
And I'd have to go left or right, and I'd have to trample over people to get out. And in the middle is loads of burning bricks in a hole with herbs over it. And they start beating their drums, which is like a baron, and they pray and sing and chant, and you copy them. And very soon you kind of figure out what they're doing, and you do it along with them. But I got very bad anxiety straight away, and my heart started going. And eventually I just kind of made the decision that I'm just rather die than leave here.
Oh really? Yeah. Out of embarrassment?
Yeah, out of embarrassment. I'd rather, like, I've done this to myself a few times, and I've, like, rather than face the embarrassment, I'm okay with death.
Oh my god,
that's the extremity I go. to not being embarrassed, especially with people who you're kind of respect or, you know, looking up to. So eventually the anxiety left, and I went on a really unique trip. You know, without smoking anything or anything like that, natural.
Nice.
And when it was over, it was 2 hours in there. When it was over, I walked outside, and everybody went into the cabin to have a sort of vegan stew, and I went out to a field to the right where it was just growing veg, and this rain came down, and it was like torrential rain, but it was warm, and I could hear coyotes, and then the thunder, it was filling the whole sky, and I was just wearing a pair of shorts, nothing else. I was like that scene at the end of Shawshank Redemption when he comes out of the tunnel.
Yeah.
So I was like, whoa. And I thought, I'll never forget this. And that night, I stayed in a teepee for half the time, just up in the mountain, basically on my own with Kim and Colm, who were there. Like, there was no lights around, there was no light pollution, and just a fire there, and staying in a teepee. And it was just like, whoa. Whenever I kind of get angry or pissed off, I go back here, and this is like my happy place, you know?
So lovely.
It was a great experience, and just amazing people. Like,
yeah, but it's just, you've had such a great life.
The last few years I've had just brilliant experiences.
And
you know,
that's mad, because if you didn't go through adversity at the start, like, you wouldn't be.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that's just.
Well, it's acting just got me into all this. This was just kind of an accident falling into it, you know.
Yeah.
And when you change your worldview, if you have a negative point of view, if you have a negative worldview, everything is going to be negative. Everything that comes at you will be negative, and you will see everything as negative. Even an opportunity, you'll see that as negative. And if you see it as negative, nothing positive can come from it. But then when you force yourself to change your mind and actually think about the possibility of something, and think maybe there is an upside here, and you actually go down that route, then you start being positive. Mm. And when you're positive, positive things happen to you. You meet positive people. Your energy mixes with other people, opportunities come, and it keeps rolling over and rolling over. And that's what I know that's almost a science to me at this point, because it's been proven over and over and over to me, you know. So
No, I believe you. Yeah. Like, that's how I feel about my life.
Yeah.
You know, like meeting people and kind of meeting people you click with, like creatively and everything. It sounds like you have that partnership.
Yeah, yeah. Know. And also just when you're open-minded about people and don't think bad of people as well, you know, and if your intentions are good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I just think good things will happen and I just think you'll enjoy yourself.
So are you writing anything else now? What's next for you? What are you thinking of doing?
I wrote a short that's in now for Film Board funding. So fingers crossed there. We didn't get funding for Carver Gangster with the Film Board, but hopefully maybe this is not really a sort of like the only kind of thing that was kind of saving me is that it's a short. I don't think it'd be very hard to get it funded if it was a feature.
Yeah.
Because of the kind of subject matter. It's called Bless You Father If You Have Sinned, and it's about the generational impact of clerical abuse, and it's told through the story of our lead, who was a heroin addict, middle-aged man heroin addict, who goes back to visit the old industrial school in which he grew up in, which is now derelict, camps up there and is faced with his past. So it's a pretty heavy thing, and it's only 10 pages. I don't know how I got it into 10 pages, but it needed to be 10 pages for the Film Board, so I met a 10 pages. So I hopefully get funding there, and I'm writing the TV show as well at the moment. I'm just kind of figuring it out, really. More kind of, I start out by writing everything as a story first, you know.
Right.
It's literally trying to tell it as a story. Because I think that's the most difficult way to do it. That's honestly what, because when you get down to dialogue and stuff like that, I think it gets easier. I think I could write fucking monologues all day, you know. But writing it as a story, you can always go back to that and see what the heart was there and what it was really about. And I can just keep it consistent the whole way, you know, and that's the way I do it. So right now I'm just writing it as a story, a TV show, and then I'm actually writing another feature, two features at the same time.
Jesus.
No, and this is not because this is literally because, and this is the God's honest truth.
Yeah.
I can't focus. Like, I constantly get ideas and I go, I have to do that, and I get bored very quick, and then like I'm in the middle of writing this feature, and I'll do a load of work on it, and then I'll just go, fuck no, that other idea is coming back to me, it's haunting me.
Yeah.
And then I have to go and just switch over to a different document and start writing that. You know what I mean?
Okay.
But I find it's all right. I'm chopping and changing, and you know, so I have to do it that way.
You're a pure player when it comes to ideas then?
Yeah, right. I'm getting, like, I've a notebook with about 50 billion ideas. And, like, all different levels, like one for a short and one for a feature and one for something huge one day. If I ever made it big, I could do this one. This is the dream.
Like a theme park, like Dollyland.
Yeah, I have a script that's, like, it's not written yet, but it's more like, I have it as a story now. And it's like Titanic meets 12 Years a Slave. And it's set in, I shouldn't be giving this idea away.
Don't give it away.
No, you keep it in.
Do.
Yeah.
Right. Well, look, let's have a look. Jesus, that's cool. We're coming up to, like, we got 10 minutes left.
Oh, no way.
So I'm going to ask you all stupid questions. Is that all right?
Fire away.
So, have you ever made, who's the most famous person you've made a cup of tea for?
Cup of tea for?
Yeah.
Famous? Let me see. I wouldn't. Who would have met it?
Do you make tea now often?
No, I wouldn't at all. But maybe like Peter Coonan. I remember he said in my camp, so I'd say I met him in an old cup.
Nice.
That'd be the most. Like, I didn't. Yeah.
And did he stay in your camp?
Yeah, he stayed in my camp. Yeah. Yeah.
And
for preparation for King of the Travelers.
Oh really?
Yeah.
So he kind of. How long did he stay for? And what kind of prep did you give him?
Drinking Guinness and stuff. he had long conversations with my grandma. Him and my grandmother got along very well, you know.
Right.
I don't know what it was, but they had a bit of a connection, and that was like about 6 years ago. And even to this day, my grandmother asks us about Peter all the time, like, you know. And anytime I meet Peter, he asks about her, and they had a great old connection, you know. And she called him the good looking blonde fella.
The
good looking blonde fella. Yeah. I think she asked one day, she's Dunhu. Oh, he looks like a Dunhu. Anybody who's slightly good looking or doing well in life is a Dunhu, you know.
Really?
And anybody who looks bad or is not doing well, she calls them a ward, which is her husband. Oh, he looks like a ward.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Oh, were the wards and Dunhus, they were like friendly families with each other?
But like they're just, because she's married to Ward, they're very competitive about their names, you know.
Yeah.
Well, more her than him, you know, but Yeah, yeah, they slag each other about it. Like, some of the best comedy I've ever seen has been them two slagging each other about each other's names.
Oh, would you know? Would you do anything on that note? Would you ever think of doing a comedy? Or?
Oh, I don't. I've done a few little bits of comedy. I'd like to do more comedy because, like, there is a certain perception of me out there. People think I'm very serious and I'm always giving out. And
well,
actually,
that's probably because we're asking, like, in fairness, I sat you down
questions.
And then I was like,
yeah,
so,
yeah.
Tell me about the plight of the track. Do you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, no, of course.
Like, it's not, it's
but
not
the funny
really...
thing is that I'm like a big agent, you know what I mean? Like, I sit down and talk absolute bollocks. Like, I have a friend of mine, Teddy, and if people listen to our conversations, trust me, their opinion of me would lower a lot more.
Oh, really?
We'll just try to talk about the most stupid, idiotic things ever, and we'll try to make up words that don't exist.
Yeah.
And stupid stuff. And I love, and laughing, because like, he's one of the funniest people I know, Teddy, you know? And, you know, I love having the crack as much as the next man.
Well, that's cool. That's cool. I think it's because you're in films and shit and people want to...
Yeah.
And even with Cardboard Gangsters, like, it's a kind of fun film, but you still, because it's an Irish film,
yeah.
I treat it like I was like, oh, this is... I had to praise it publicly because I wanted people to watch
the support
Irish films.
Isn't that terrible that it has to...
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so...
We have to do that.
Yeah, we definitely do.
Because it's not the norm.
No, you know? No, it's not. Like, if I watch... Because I got a Cineworld card, so I watch... The films, what did I watch? Baby Driver. I wouldn't tweet about Baby Driver.
No,
do you know?
No.
Wouldn't give a fuck.
See, here's the thing as well. Like, if our cinemas are not taking in Irish films.
No.
Like, now more than ever, Irish films being made. So, like, if you look in South Korea, they have a system where 40% of the films in the cinemas have to be Korean.
Right.
Have to be. And as a result, that was about 10 or 15 years ago they brought it in. Now their cinema is huge. Korean cinema now is amazing. Now it's amazing. Some of the most interesting films that are being made in the world today are being made over in Korea, believe it or not. And people are going to watch Korean films. I think we need to do something like that. And if you look at even a thing like the IFI, the Irish Film Institute, they're a disgrace. And I mean it. And I'm giving out about them 3 or 4 years, 5 years maybe. They don't take in enough Irish films, and they're called the Irish Film Institute. Their sole purpose is to promote Irish film.
Yeah.
Not even with Cardboard Gangsters, and this isn't about Cardboard Gangsters. I'm on record as criticising these for years.
Yeah.
But even with Cardboard Gangsters, I think we got like, I'm not sure if it was either 1 week or 2 weeks.
No.
Just run with them, right? Yet we are by a lot of money, by a distance, the most successful Irish film of the year in the box office, right? Despite the fact we couldn't get funding and we're a very low-budget film with a huge cast, against all the odds, we are the biggest budget film of the year, and he pulled us out after just a week or two running when all the other cinemas are keeping us, but the Irish Film Institute pulls out.
Do you think that's a class thing?
I think so. Yeah. I think if you look at the Irish film industry, it's very elitist. And if you look at everybody who are involved, from directors, writers, producers, and people who are involved in funding, they all come from the same sort of background. They all, and look, this is probably fucking me own self by saying it, but they all come from...
Ah, you're big enough now, you'd be grand.
I don't really care anyway, like, but they're all coming from upper-class backgrounds in South Dublin, basically, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not being bad, but that's just the truth. And what happens is they all go to the same schools. They all basically have their own little clique and culture. And when reading scripts, they know their own man, and he's my man, and I went to Blackrock College with him, or, you know what I mean? Or St. Andrews, or whatever it is. And it's a big, big clique. It's tribalism, you know?
Do you think, John, they should assimilate more? Like, I think
it,
look after their own.
It goes, I think we just need more diversity in all levels of filmmaking, you know what I mean? And right to the funding route. Like, I know that the film board now have a lot of women on it. Like, I think they have like 17 or 18 women and 3 or 4 men. And that's cool, because for years it was the other way around.
Yeah.
And it's about time we're getting some of that. But dare I say, talk about class. No one wants to talk about class. Like, most of them women, I guarantee, if not all them women and men, are all from the same class. They're all upper middle class people. You know what I mean? Like, so I want class diversity too, not just gender diversity, you know?
Well, I just feel odd about the whole, like, Jobstown
and ethnic
not
diversity.
Guilty.
Yeah.
Yeah, ethnic diversity as well. But the whole Jobstown not guilty thing, the way it was covered in mainstream media was just odd. It was just odd because you have them, they were found not guilty. Yet that lad who is the head of the Olympics that got arrested in Brazil, now he hasn't gone to trial or anything like that, but he's got a front page spread saying about his innocence and stuff. Yeah. What's the difference?
Well, look where he's from, look where his background and all that. And they're working class people who were who were accused of that, and they're going against the arms of the state, and like who look who owns the papers, who owns the media, and then you have a video of them talking about lunch and blah blah blah, and they're meant to be terrified and frozen and traumatized, and they're there talking about where they're going to have lunch or something. Mm. You know what I mean? Like I think the judge actually said in it, forget about the human. Forget about the human testimonies. A human memory can't be trusted. Look at the video. Which basically said that the guards are lying.
Yeah.
Every guard came in with the exact identical story. Why do human beings do that? You know, so yeah, that's a good thing. I actually wonder that if they were found guilty, would it have been better in a way? A sort of martyr syndrome. Would it give people would it give people a kick up the arse to get their shit together? And let's, you know, think about doing something like what's happening over in Britain right now with Corbyn, you know, and the people are getting mobilised, mass movements of people, you know, and I think they're heading to a left government eventually over there. I hope we are.
It's just sad that you know, Joan Burton was a member of Labour, and I don't think there's going to be a similar kind of like Labour resurgence in Ireland.
No, I'm not talking about Labour.
I know, it should be left. But
no, Labour are gone. Labour are just neoliberals. So yeah. I wouldn't have faith on Labour. I'm talking about Independent Alliance, Solidarity Movement, Sinn Féin. I'd love to see a big left coalition. That's what I'd love to see happen, you know?
Yeah.
But the funny thing about just going back to that Jobstown was that they really ran on the whole misogynist and anti-woman thing, and when the vast majority of protesters were women, they just picked out the men to run with that. That was one of the narratives then to run with, you know. So they'll use anything they can at their disposal.
I think there's this weird impasse now at the moment between people on like the far left spectrum and women, because I see there's always rows all the time. Because I come from a council estate, so I don't give a shit about middle class women problems as much as I give a shit about, you know, like, so I find it odd that the word misogyny gets thrown at people that are on the far left.
It's thrown a lot for so I see it thrown a lot for no reason.
No.
And what you were touching on something there, like within the feminist movement in Ireland anyway, and most of the place, and what's always been a huge problem with feminists is with the movements and the class issues within the movements.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And that's a big problem in Ireland. Like the feminist movements, the movements are kind of being controlled, or the main people speaking are really privileged women who, for the most part, would be more privileged than a lot of men. Men who come from working class backgrounds, traveller backgrounds, poor, you know, council estates. Like an upper class woman from Fox Rock, I'm sorry to say, is going to have a more privileged life.
Well, they're going to have the time to think about these issues. Do you know what I mean?
Of course they are. Of course they are.
My cousins, my mum, I'm sure you, like, they don't have the time. Your relatives don't have the time to fucking set up a Facebook campaign or something like that.
I remember being encountered by one of these, were from a very privileged background, this woman, and she had the cheek to tell me if a woman stays at home and raise the kids, or single mother, can't be a feminist.
Well, that's...
And I went, what?
She's talking shite.
I went, that is absolute bollocks.
Yeah.
Like, a woman who was a single mother raising her children, where do you get a bigger example of strength?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the hardest thing in the world you can do. That's what my mother done.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. There's a lot of box ticking that you need to be doing for all of them, but I just think they're looking after themselves. No one wants to talk about class.
No.
And that's the big problem in Ireland.
And how do you feel about box ticking yourself? Because you're from a minority and stuff.
Yeah, I got it. There's a lot of the kind of token traveller, patronising kind of stuff, and I get it all the time. The thing that kind of encourages me is that I just fuck them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Fuck them. And I've belief in myself that one day that I don't need to know these people, or I don't need a yes from these people, that I'm going to go beyond these people, and these are the people in the room, and I'm going to get bigger than the room. And that's not being it's not a braggadocious thing, I don't mean that, but I mean even just the level of artistry, I'm developing all the time and evolving all the time and learning about life all the time. I don't know what I'm going to even be doing in 10 years, but I know I'm going to be at a different level to where I am now.
What is this? I bet you 10 years ago you didn't think you were going to be in a house with bricks and herbs. And
no, this 10 years ago, this would have been ludicrous, sitting down here today talking about this kind of stuff.
Really? You know what I
mean? It would have been absolutely ludicrous.
Cool.
So, yeah, there you go.
Well, there you go. I think Well, we are 3 minutes over time. But look, and like, I feel so, because I just really am interested in your life and stuff, and I feel so weird going, so you're a traveller, tell me about that, you know.
Yeah, but it's like, sort of the obvious, you know what I mean? Like,
it is.
Yeah,
it totally is.
It is, and it informs. It's my own fault anyway, because I didn't just go down the road to be an actor. I ended up getting involved in political activism, whatever, which is, I'm just as known for that as I am for acting. So, and that's okay, you know. It's just about having the right conversation about that kind of thing. And I think we did that today successfully.
Yay! Cool. Well, thank you so much, John.
Thanks for having me.
Beautiful. Now, let's open this window and put on our
bag. Oh, jeez.
I am boiling. Yeah. I am boiling.
Like a boiled egg.
Now, that was John Connors. Cardboard Gangsters should still be in the cinemas this week. Go check it out. If you can't get there in time to go to the cinema, get it on DVD or just don't download it illegally, because it's like shoplifting from your local small village shop. You know John, you know his family. Not John Connors. I mean, this is the hypothetical John. Well, if John Connors owned a sweet shop, a small, nice family run sweet shop, you've been there all your life, and you start stealing links, or I don't know what you would shoplift. Smoked salmon, that's a high value item. But anyway, don't do that. That's what I'm trying to say. Get it in a legal way. But steal all the American ones, because fuck them. They have enough money. like if Angelina Jolie opened up a corner shop, I'd shoplift her. And it wouldn't just be smoked salmon. It would be penny sweets. I'd go behind the counter and I'd rob it and I'd go, come on, Angelina. Because I'd say, I don't know why I want to bully her, actually. That's not nice. She hasn't done much harm to me. And, I mean, that goes a bit beyond shoplifting. That's... Anyway. So, you want to hear this news that I got some live shows coming up. Vodafone Comedy Festival. I'm doing 4 shows at the Vodafone Comedy Festival in the Ivy Gardens in Dublin. It is one of my favourite festivals to do. It, hands down... It's just, I love it so much because they bring over class Americans and they have the big Irish headliners, and I get to be on the same bill as these class people. So, yeah, thanks so much to Brendan Aiken for setting up the festival and doing it and giving something that people can do in late July that involves comedy. I think it's really cool. It's only 3 minutes long, this thing so far. Cool, I thought I was chatting a lot of shite. But anyway, on the Thursday of the Vodafone Comedy Festival, you can find all the information on my Facebook page, Alison Spittle Comedy, I think it's called. I've also got a Facebook competition happening at the moment, because on the Thursday, I'm doing a gig. I'm emceeing a gig with Rory Scoville, Nate Bargatze, and Tommy Tiernan. And I'm so excited about that. You can buy tickets for that. And on the Friday, I'm doing a gig. It's a Alison Spittle Show podcast recording. Now, last year I did it with David O'Doherty and Maeve Higgins, and it was a big ball of crack. And this year I'm doing it with Rady Pete and Tommy Tiernan. So I'm super excited about interviewing him. It's going to be a good crack. I presume it'll be a good crack. Like, sometimes you have nightmares where... You know, it's like when your teeth fall out and you go, Tommy Tiernan might not like you, Alison. But I think he will. I think he'll be grand. Positive attitude. They're just anxiety dreams I am having. It's either Tommy Tiernan not like me or my mum dying. Those are the two anxiety dreams that I have at the moment. There's a little insight into my brain. And then we got some more live shows coming up. At the Vodafone Comedy Festival, I'm also emceeing a gig with Maeve Higgins and Garrod Farley and Catherine Bonhart and James. Now, I don't know how to pronounce the second name. It's either Veitch or Vetch, or I've really fucked it up. But I don't know him to ask him, and I don't know if you can Google. I'll see. Can you Google pronunciations? How? What was that? Sorry, that was the washing up. How do I pronounce? pronounce. Yeah, let's try this now. How'd you say it? Yeah. Tree audio voice. Let's hear it. Play it out. I can't hear that. Wait there.
James Beach. James Beach.
Yeah. I think that's a parody. That's not real. I mean, he's slobbering too much. He can't. I mean, I would never set up a YouTube channel telling people how to pronounce stuff because of my lisp and my weird mongrel Irish English accent. I know it doesn't sound very English now, but sometimes I get caught out and trouble ensues. So, yeah. Fuck that. No, that's not the way. Right. Well, anyway, that guy. And then on the Sunday, I am co-hosting The Guilty Feminist with Deborah Frances White and Liz Meal. So I am super, super excited about it. It's going to be great for me. I am excited about it. And I know it'll be super great for people that want to come along. Because, look, if you buy a ticket, let's say if you bought a ticket for like the Tommy Tiernan show on the Friday, you could get in there earlier. Like the Tommy Tiernan show, I think it's on at like 9:30. Get in there early, get in there at 7 and you could go watch. There's loads of street entertainment. I've just moved into a new house and it says it's got double glazing. But I just hear traffic all the time. I don't, yeah, it's a lovely house otherwise. I'm not living with the two tramps I lived with before. I'm just living with one lad and I'm very happy about that. Anyway, what was I saying? Double glazing? No. Oh yeah, just the great value of the Vodafone Comedy Festival is, it is good value. That's all I'm going to say now. I can't convince you anymore. I've tried. Now, August 20th, I haven't booked a gig. I haven't booked a guest for it yet because I only thought about it today. I've texted someone, so hopefully he'll text back. Or it could be she, you know, keep a bit of mystery. But, that's August the 20th, and that's going to be in the Workman's during the day. So, August the 20th, and they haven't told me the time yet, but I'll find out. But, it'd be good crack. I suppose I better go. Jesus, I thought I wasn't talking to you, because the last time I looked at the time, it was 3 minutes, and now it's up to 9. I'm very sorry, lads. We'll go to credits. Thank you so much to Andrea Farrell. And by the way, I might as well say as well, like, if you're waiting for a show 2 weeks ago and it didn't come and you're disappointed, first off, oh, that's class. You wait for my shows. That makes me really happy. Secondly, I'm so sorry. We did a gig at the Body and Soul Festival in Westmead and some technical problems happened. So we couldn't use the recording. But, you know, shit happens and I've been doing this podcast over a year and it's the first time it's happened. And you're always expecting it, you know, the gremlins to hit one time. So, yeah, feck it. It's grand. I had Chris and Kira on from 2FM. And it was great crack. We talked about terrorism and famous people's willies. And, that's all I can remember. And, yeah. And then I asked some audience members to ask some questions. And they were better questions than mine. And I was a bit sickened. So shout out to the two wonderful lads that asked questions at Body and Soul. So apologies for that. But I'm not apologising too hard because I'm trying not to apologise as much. So it's a small apology. But I acknowledge it. Right, credits. Andrea Farrell. Sarah Garvey, the wonderful lady who edits this show and gets stuff together. She's the best. No Monster Club, you heard their song that as my theme tune. They do my theme tune. Also, happy birthday to the lead singer of No Monster Club, Bobby. He got to meet Dustin for his birthday, so happy birthday. Artwork by William Conway. go check out, just Google him. And he's not the judge. There's a William Conway that's a judge. That judge is dead and he didn't do my artwork. It's William Conway. Type in Westmead as well, I suppose, and you'll find him. He's really good. Alan Bennett and everyone at Headstuff as well. They've been properly nice. And I'll let you go. Thank you. Bye.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.